Welcome to the Rennie Podcast, where we talk about the real estate market and the people connected by it. Our goal is to empower you to make informed decisions and provide context for the real estate world around you. We hope that with every episode, you will become a little more knowledgeable and a lot more curious.
Welcome to the Rennie Podcast. I'm Ryan Berlin, Rennie's head economist and vice president of intelligence.
And I'm Will Yee. I'm the Rennie U.S. market intelligence analyst.
How was your Mother's Day weekend?
It was good. As you know, I'm originally from Vancouver, and so I'm now in Seattle, but just that we're filming here today in Vancouver. So opportunity for me to come here, spend the weekend with my mom. So she's very happy about that.
Amazing. And you didn't have to get her a gift because it was just your presence. That was the present.
Exactly.
So this is the first podcast episode that you and I have recorded together. And you're here because we've just published the first edition of the Seattle Rennie Landscape. Right. We'll get into that in more detail shortly. But why don't you start by just telling us a little bit about what you do at Rennie, what you're interested in, what turns your crank, and how we got to sitting here recording this episode.
Yeah. So as I mentioned, I'm the market analyst on the US side. So I do very similar things to what you and the team does, just with an American spin on it, I guess. Mm. I think of my core responsibility just to provide clarity and guidance to anyone we work with. So that's our Rennie advisors, colleagues at our head office, our developer clients, and just sort of provide engaging, but also useful, easy to digest insights. There's a lot of noise in the market, a lot going on right now. So, my goal is just to provide some clarity wherever that's possible. So I was actually born and raised here in Vancouver, and like Rennie sort of has expanded into the US market. So I currently live in Seattle. So I have sort of a foundation of both sides, and that's how I knew of Rennie before joining. I really love storytelling. I love to read. And so it was a nice natural marriage for me for this job in terms of going through the housing market, real estate, which I enjoy, but also getting to tell stories on.
Yeah. And it's great to have you on board. And obviously what you do really mirrors what we do north of the border. And it's, imperative for our business to have that intelligence presence in the US. It's been great having you here for the past 3-4 months at this point. And in that time, you managed to pen the first edition of the Rennie Landscape report, which is no small feat. Just so everyone who's listening or watching this knows, the Rennie Landscape is our semi-annual signature report, if you will. It's produced by the intelligence division. And I guess what's unique about it across that continuum of content that Rennie Intelligence produces is that it's far less focused on some of those traditional real estate metrics like sales and listings and prices and how those things are changing. And it's more concerned with the wide variety of things, factors that influence a housing market. So we're talking about trends in the macro economy, interest rates, inflation, policy. We look at trends in credit and debt. We look at demographics. And then we look at aspects of the housing market that aren't necessarily all about sales and listings. We look at the mortgage market. We look at construction trends. So all of that is contained in the landscape. And the idea really is to understand how those factors, so ranging from global to national to more local, impact, in this case, the housing market in the greater Seattle region.
We produce a variety of content from, monthly reports are focused on MLS stats, but there's a lot more to just to the housing market overall. And this is really our flagship report that covers all those things. It's meant so that you can read it front to back, back to front, or you can just pick the topics that interest you. Whether it's demographics, the economy, interest rates.
And if you're watching this or listening to this, you can access the Seattle Rennie Landscape Report on our website at rennie.com/intelligence. Excellent. Let's get on with the show.
Yeah.
Broadly speaking, there are a few key themes that emerge from the report that we'll cover today. We'll talk about the amount of noise in the current headlines, from inflation to tariffs to volatility and uncertainty. We'll talk about a resilient labor market nationally and a resilient housing market more locally. And then finally, as we look ahead, we're seeing continued population growth against a backdrop of somewhat constrained housing supply. Mm-hmm. Let's start unpacking some of the more relevant insights that you've landed on, Will, as you put together this report, as they relate to the housing market in Puget Sound. Okay, so if you're someone who, say, not an economist. Lucky you. Lucky you if you're not an economist. So if you're not an economist, how should you be viewing the US economy right now? Like, is there a single lens through which to be looking at things?
Yeah. I think it's a great place to start. I mean, the economy is like such that there's so many different ways that you can slice it that sometimes depending on where you're looking, you can come away with a very different takeaway. Mm-hmm. That's especially true right now. I mean, as you alluded to earlier, you can look at something like interest rates and inflation, which after 3 years in the US, especially having come down meaningfully, you can look at the equity markets. Anyone who's been paying attention to their stock portfolios recently probably have lost some sleep. Or you can just look at confidence indices, which are at all-time lows. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to times like these where the data is a little bit muddy or cloudy or conflicting in different ways, I like to just start at the bottom and sort of zoom out from there. I think in this case, a good place to start is with the labor market. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can talk about, you know, GDP, interest rates, all we want. But I think at the end of the day, whether or not you have your job and how you feel, how secure you feel in your position, that has the greatest impact to how someone feels about the economy and how they behave.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think starting from there, I mean, everything considered, the labor market has been surprisingly firm and a source of strength over the past 3 years. Mm. I mean, across the board, if you go down the employment metrics, they've been more firm than long-term averages. So you think of something like the unemployment rate has been really consistently low and below long-term averages. Wage growth has been quite strong and actually has outpaced inflation in recent years. And so if you go down the list, you know, participation rate, all these things have held up quite firmly in spite of everything that we've been through over the past few years with, you know, the COVID pandemic, the associated problem with that, interest rates at generationally high levels, mm-hmm. and inflation at 7%+ at the peak in the US. Mm-hmm. Through all that, firms have kept relatively stable, have kept growing, and have posted quite consistent results.
As I have tracked the labor market in the US over the past few years and watched it evolve, it has been remarkable at how resilient it's been in the face of all of these quote unquote threats, right? Like you said, with the high inflation and the response of the Federal Reserve, which was to raise interest rates, we saw longer term rates increase, mortgage rates increase. So life did become more expensive. Like if you owned a home or you didn't, but you just buy stuff, everything costs more. But through all that, US firms were continuing to hire. So yeah, we're in an interesting spot now, I think, with the labor market, because there has been it has been a source of continued strength. On a net basis, the country has been adding jobs, but we're now, you know, in some ways, I guess the labor market data is lagging. It tells us about what happened most recently last month, but not necessarily doesn't tell us where things are going. And what we're seeing now, particularly in the last few months, is there's a lot more uncertainty in the market. Consumer sentiment has kind of taken a turn for the worse. You know, we're in an interesting transition period here. And now, like, actually parsing the labor market data month to month becomes increasingly important to understand not just what that headline number is, but what is that underlying composition of jobs by sector and part-time versus full-time, and are young people still employed, mm-hmm. And those kind of things. Recognizing that broader context of seemingly daily changes to U.S. trade and tariff policy, we're seeing these huge swings in equities markets and also in debt markets. If you were a CEO of a company with all of this stuff swirling around you, would you view this as a good time to hire?
Yeah, I think that's a great point. I mean, definitely not, right? I think what we're seeing right now is we're not quite at the point where mass layoffs are happening. But to your point, if you have a decision whether or not to expand to a new market or to grow your business a lot, now would probably not be the best time to make that decision. And so I think we're really in a bit of a lull or a freeze right now. I think to your point earlier, a lot of the recent uncertainty that we're seeing right now really began in the past few months. Mm-hmm. And labor data tends to move with a 1 to 3 month lag, just with revisions and capturing the most recent impacts. And so anecdotally, you know, I think if you, a lot of our listeners at home, if you have friends or acquaintances that are looking in the job market right now, it's not necessarily all roses as I may have been painting so far. I think a lot of firms are now at a point where they're saying, let's just take a step back and see where things go. But if the current activity continues to persist, I do think we will be start to see some of that softening on labor numbers appear much more in the data.
A big part of me would be surprised if we didn't see that.
Yeah.
I just think, you know, you're right that if your market conditions and therefore the future are uncertain, yeah, it's probably not a time for all companies to reinvest in their workforce or even in technology or new space. It's just uncertainty does not create that foundation for medium to longer term planning, right? And I think that's, we'll get to it more, but that's also what's afflicting the housing market right now as well, because buyers just aren't sure what lies ahead for the economy and what that means for inflation and interest rates, but also for many people, what it means for their own job,
right?
So we'll get to that in a little bit more detail. But I think what it gets to the heart of is, you know, in some ways, when we collectively, we look at the economy, we're cynics, I think. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before on the podcast, written about it before, this idea that, you know, we're either in a recession or we're simply waiting for the next one to arrive. So as we look ahead, I know it's very difficult to forecast in this environment, but as we look ahead, what are you anticipating?
Yeah. So, I mean, we're definitely not in a recession right now. So by your logic, we should be anticipating one. But yeah, I think that's a great caveat to add, like a prediction, especially for recession prediction, they're always just that, a prediction. At the same time, you know, I'm not sure if you've seen the recent memes online about recession indicators.
I haven't.
Okay. Well, there'll be a guy on TikTok pointing to, you know, the price of eggs or the price of gasoline and saying, or, you know, Mercury's in retrograde and say, oh, recession confirmed. I think there's a lot of just speculation right now.
Right.
I think, but at the same time, I think there are some actually compelling reasons to be cautious right now. One of them is the yield curve, which is an indicator that the Federal Reserve tends to track quite closely. You know, without getting too much into the weeds of how to calculate the curve and such, you know, in the past few decades, every single U.S. recession has been preceded by an inversion of this curve, which is the indicator that we're looking at.
Which is, what does that mean? Like in layman's terms?
So we're looking at US government debt at the moment. And so the US will offer maturities of different lengths. So we have the 10-year maturity notes versus the 3-month versus the 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And typically investors will expect a higher rate of return for a longer maturity. You're tying up your money for a longer time.
Yeah, there's more risk. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
And typically, you know, in normal circumstances, the yield on the 10-year one is higher because of that. But in terms of economic uncertainty, that relationship inverts. And so the yields on the shorter term rates end up being higher than the long term rates. And that's just investors saying, you know, look, I think things are getting dicey in the short term. I think that I'd rather accept a lower rate of return over the longer horizon rather than subject myself to some of these shorter term uncertainties. And so what we're seeing recently is that curve has inverted, particularly during COVID, where 3-month note particularly had a highest interest rate than the 10-year maturity. And like I alluded to earlier, every single US recession has been preceded by this inversion.
The line is that the yield curve has predicted 9 of the last 5 recessions. An inverted yield curve doesn't necessarily mean that a recession is guaranteed.
There's different types of yield curves.
Mm-hmm.
And overall, sometimes there have been false positives,
mm-hmm.
right? The one I'm talking about specifically actually has never had a false positive.
Mm-hmm.
And they've actually never missed a recession.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has a very compelling track record. And that's the reason that the Federal Reserve will specifically look at this one.
So I know we're talking a lot about recessions here, and I'm kind of the mindset that a recession is binary, right? You're either in a recession or you're not in a recession. We don't know if we'll actually technically be in recession territory in the coming 6 and 12 months. But I think what's likely is that we're going to see a slowdown in the economy. I think that's kind of the big takeaway for me. There's some sort of dark clouds over the economy, but if we turn to housing, what are you seeing for homeowners as the economy sort of evolves downward a little bit? Are we going to see fire sales? Are we going to see falling prices? What do you anticipate?
Here's where the housing market starts to behave a lot differently than some of the other markets, like we talk about, like the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you know, real estate generally is considered an illiquid asset. So, you know, if you think of if someone loses their job, they might sell off some of their stock portfolio to cover their expenses, right? It's not the same with their home. Nobody wants to lose, you know, your home. It's your anchor. It's your source of stability. And that sense of prioritization is matched up in the data. So we've seen that in times of economic strain, households will prioritize paying down their mortgage debt ahead of other types of debt, like, you know, auto debt, credit cards. So in that sense, housing markets are sort of naturally insulated from some of the faster or more volatile movements in markets. And even if someone were, you know, unfortunately forced to sell their home, it would still come with some lag. You need to find, you know, list your home, prepare it, find a buyer, close. So with that all being said, the housing market tends to move with a lag from the wider stock market. So with all that being said, I think just naturally, we definitely are still at risk of declining prices. Mm. But just naturally speaking, there's some breathing room there and some insulation there from the most dramatic sort of dips that we might be seeing in other kinds of markets.
So why don't we get down to the Seattle housing market? Mm-hmm. So prices absolutely tend to be downward sticky for a whole bunch of reasons. There are lags. People who own their home will essentially sacrifice other assets that they have before they give up on their principal residence. But, you know, that being said, we do see periods where prices do fall or they fail to increase. And, you know, I think it's reasonable to assume that we're going to be in a period where we're not going to see rapidly rising prices. I don't see a lot of tailwinds there. But maybe you can speak to the current situation within the greater Seattle housing market as sort of some context for some of this broader forward-looking stuff that we're talking about.
So I think, like, another way to put what I just said is, you know, some of those factors are external to the Seattle housing market.
Yeah.
And housing markets just generally are a little bit more resistant to external forces. We can also turn to look at, you know, our local markets specifically to see if there's any inherent signs of strain or cracks are beginning to emerge. So when we're looking at the Seattle market specifically, you know, inventory levels right now are about at 10-year averages for a single family. You might expect with just the slower pace of sales that inventory levels would be higher, but I think it's just a function of what you're talking about earlier. Homeowners are stubborn, prices tend to be sticky downwards, and if people aren't getting the prices that they want, they're not gonna list their homes for sale. At the same time, if we do see some of this negativity persist, homeowners may be forced or, you know, incentivized further to sell against their wishes. One way to start looking at if that's showing up is to look at delinquency rates in other kinds of debt. So as I mentioned earlier, delinquency rates tend to rise the latest. But when we're looking at Washington numbers, auto debt and credit card debt are above 10-year averages and have been rising consistently over the past 3 years. Mortgage delinquency rates aren't quite there yet, but should these rates, delinquency rates persist, we would expect mortgage rates to follow. And that will lead into, you know, 60-day delinquency rates, 90-day, and eventually foreclosures. See inventory flooding the market or entering when there's not an equivalent demand asking for that. That's when we tend to see prices softening or...
Yeah, that's right. And I think there's a risk here, obviously, for within the Seattle market where we are seeing delinquency rates, as you said, rising for things like credit cards and other personal loans. If the labor market becomes destabilized, then it sort of just amplifies some of these pre-existing trends. And there are fewer buffers to the housing market and the mortgage market when other sources of credit are not in great shape, so to speak. As it relates back to the mortgage market, when we look at mortgage rates, obviously, you know, we're about 5 years clear of the lowest mortgage rates on record. And they rose significantly over the following few years. Where do they sit now? And like, as we look ahead through this year, maybe a little bit beyond.
There is also some good news when we dig a little bit deeper into mortgage rates specifically as well. You know, in the U.S., current 30-year fixed mortgage rates are about 6.8% today, which is pretty much where we were at as of last year. So, you know, it's been a lot slower of a loosening path than we had expected. Last week, the Fed just paused again, and we don't expect the pace of loosening to increase. And so there is a worry that for homeowners that maybe bought a few years ago during low periods of low rates, if they're forced to refinance, will that cause some strain? Yeah, so I think the interesting thing here, when we dive into a little bit more mortgage rates specifically, is that the distribution of outstanding debt in the U.S., mortgage debt, is actually quite positive. Mm-hmm. In that, because we have the 30-year fixed mortgage available to us, a lot of people took advantage of that low rate window in 2020, 2021, and locked in really generationally low interest rates of 2 to 3%. Mm-hmm. And those people are really sitting on those rates at the moment, and they actually account for nearly a quarter of all outstanding debt. So it's nearly a quarter of all outstanding debt. That's quite a surprise considering, you know, when we're talking about interest rates these days, mm-hmm. you know, the headlines are, 6-8% elevated interest rates. But just given that window, I think a lot of homeowners smartly and correctly mm-hmm. lock those in. And so when we actually compare the overall distribution to 2015, back in 2015, about 2/3 of mortgages had rates above 5%. So if you think about those kind of homeowners, and they're forced to contend with rates for a longer time, and they lose their jobs, they're just at a naturally a much higher risk of defaulting, a financial strain. Nearly a third of Washington homeowners today are sort of insulated from that, relatively speaking, because of the fact that they took advantage of those low rates.
That is a very good thing for the stability of housing markets. And honestly, the stability of neighborhoods and communities, right? That people are, you know, sort of not regardless of what happens to the economy, but, you know, we can see a bit of devolution in economic conditions, and households have, you know, a good proportion of borrowers, homeowners have, let's say, a little bit of a buffer, somewhat favorable terms, right? Against the backdrop of higher current market rates, it creates that lock-in effect where homeowners are reluctant or unable to move because they face much higher carrying costs going forward.
Another way to think about it would be, you know, given that 1/3 of current homeowners have rates under 3%, about 1/3 of the inventory in Seattle, you're going to need significant motivation to get those people to list their homes.
Right. Yeah. That's a good way of looking at it. So there's some context for the next section that we want to segue into, which is about the tremendous growth that is population growth that is being seen in the Seattle region. So sort of despite that backdrop, the region continues to grow. It's one of the fastest growing states in the US. A lot of the growth is driven by international migration. What does that mean for housing and housing demand?
Yeah, I mean, so we just talked about the other side of the equation, supply, right? This is really the other side. Over 2020 to 2023, Washington was the sixth fastest growing state by percentage. A lot of that is being driven by international migration. So when we actually look at interstate migration, more people are leaving Washington state for other parts of the US than coming in. Mm. But when we account for foreign migration from other countries, that catapults us quickly to the top of the list. I think a lot of that is a factor of just the local job market we have there. Mm-hmm. But really for the housing market, what that means is that despite some of the maybe macro or external forces to the market, there's going to be this underlying current of demand that will support prices in the medium to long term. The current administration has some shifting policies on immigration, so that might change in the coming years. But definitely, it is a source of, you know, encouragement if homeowners are worried about falling home prices.
Right. So yeah, it's not necessarily that prices are going to rise, but it's that counterbalance to maybe a softening housing market that currently, not because of structural reasons, but more cyclical ones, has a little bit more inventory, and there's obviously a bit more uncertainty out there as well. And so, on that topic of supply, you note in the landscape report that we can forecast housing deliveries by considering current data on building permits. What are the numbers telling us about what's coming to the market or not coming to the market in the next few years?
So just broadly speaking, Washington State over the past decade has seen a huge explosion of construction activity in general. And when we look at the permits and completion data, we can see that they track very closely together. Mm-hmm. And I think naturally that makes sense.
Yeah.
Every home that needs to be built needs to be permitted. And so we will see that in the data before anyone can even touch the dirt. And so when we look at today's permitting data, a huge divergence has been occurring. Mm-hmm. Since 2020, completions are up 25% at about 16,000 multifamily completions per year.
Okay.
At the same time, over the same time period, permits are down 39%, right? And so what that means is that in the coming years, there's just simply less in the pipeline that will come to market. Even if market conditions improve, demand really returns in a meaningful way, developers aren't going to be able to bring the matching amount of supply to market. We can say with great confidence that in the coming years, completions of new homes specifically is going to drop dramatically. That coupled with the population growth we just talked about is just another sign of the structural strengths and resilience in the Washington market that's sort of going to help us weather some of the greater macro forces that are at play.
Right. Yeah. It's obviously a very difficult time to be, challenging time to be a forecaster. Mm-hmm. But I think one can have maybe more confidence in that type of forecast than almost any other housing or economic related one, because there's a necessary order to the provision of new housing.
Yeah. And it's not to say that, you know, home prices won't decline mm-hmm. or that we won't see negativity in the market, but it sort of creates a natural floor in the market.
Great. So really enjoy that conversation. Obviously, very wide ranging. There's a lot covered here as a reflection of what is written about in the Rennie landscape, which includes not only words, but lots of visuals as well. And if I had to summarize essentially what I'm hearing from you today is that despite the noise in the market, in the headlines about the market, from inflation to tariffs and volatility and uncertainty, as we talked about earlier, you know, for now or up until this point, the labor market has been a source of strength for the country's economy and also the more local economy. We are seeing some strains starting to emerge potentially, but I think we need a few more months of data to really confirm that there's potentially a new direction in the labor market data. We don't know that yet. Mm-hmm. So in housing, the story is really one of resilience. We have low interest debt. We have current inventory levels that are really in line with the long run average. And looking forward, we see real potential for limited new housing to be delivered to the market. So as you said, that should help to stabilize or put a floor under values. And at the same time, Seattle is a region that people want to live in, that people continue to move to. So when we look long-term and we look at demographic changes and how a market is evolving against that backdrop of trends in housing construction, demand can shift a lot faster than supply. So we go through these periods of mismatch mm-hmm. where sometimes we have too much housing for the population mm-hmm. and other times where it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And I think we're likely, based on the work that you've done, to be moving in a direction of just a tighter, maybe more stabilized housing market over the coming years.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. I think what stands out to me really is that, you know, the macro numbers, the macro headlines are very loud right now. And I think ironically, that's a great time to start leaning into more concrete numbers or some of the more local fundamentals. I think that's a major story playing out right now. Mm-hmm. You know, structurally, there's nothing inherently difficult or worrying about the Seattle housing market. It's more of a factor of weathering out the current anxieties in the market.
Right.
And once, you know, hopefully some of these clouds pass, the Seattle market is ready and sort of poised for growth.
Again, if anyone who's listening or watching wants to read more, they can check out the spring edition of the Seattle Rennie Landscape at rennie.com/intelligence. Will, thanks for being a part of this. It was a lot of fun having this conversation. We'll do it again in 6 months.
Until next time.
Okay.
Thank you for tuning into the Rennie Podcast, where we share our passion for homes, housing, community, and cities. We hope that today's episode sparked the same curiosity in you that drives us every day. If you enjoyed the conversation, don't forget to subscribe and follow us on your favorite podcast platform. And if you have a moment, we'd love for you to leave a review. It helps others discover the insights, analysis, and perspective we bring from the Rennie Intelligence Division. For the latest market updates, be sure to register at rennie.com.
Thank you for joining us on the Rennie Podcast. If you'd like to learn more, all resources mentioned in the episode can be found at rennie.com/intelligence. To be the first to receive this information, register for intelligence updates.